Welcome to Socrates in the City. Today, it is my great joy to interview someone I've known for a long time. I call him Robbie George, but his real name is Dr. Robert P. George, or technically, since he has three doctorates, Dr. Robert P. George. He's the McCormick Professor of Jurisprudence and Director of the James Madison Program in American Ideals and Institutions at Princeton University. He served as Chairman of the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom and on the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights and the U.S. President's Council on Bioethics. He's also been the U.S. member of UNESCO's World Commission on the Ethics of Scientific Knowledge and Technology. But haven't we all? Robbie George, welcome.
It's a pleasure to be on with you, Eric. Great to see you again.
It's so much fun to talk to you, or at least even to think about talking to you, but now I actually get to talk to you. You do have three doctorates. I just want to start there. In what?
Well, they're all from Oxford, a doctor of philosophy.
Now, listen, there's no need to show off. We're already impressed, Robbie. So you have three doctorates from Oxford. Okay, all right. I don't.
It's all right. You're forgiven.
But in what are they?
So my doctorate of philosophy is in the philosophy of law. And then I have a degree called the Doctor of Civil Law, which is what Oxford calls a higher doctorate. It's the doctorate above the PhD, or what Oxford calls the DPhil. And then I have a Doctor of Letters in political philosophy, and it's another one of the so-called higher doctorates. Before the PhD degree was introduced, which was the late 19th century, the doctorates that you had at the great universities, Oxford, Cambridge, those types of places, were the Doctor of Divinity, of course, the Doctor of Civil Law, the Doctor of Science, the Doctor of Letters, and the Doctorate of Music. Very few people had those doctorates, and you couldn't actually sign up for a course to get the doctorate. You were awarded the doctorate on the basis of a lifetime, in many cases, or nearly a lifetime.
Sort of like the honorary doctorate.
They're not honorary, though.
But they're not honorary.
They're not honorary.
This would be the time for me to say that I have five honorary doctorates. Thank you very much.
I have 23.
I was going to say, I knew it. You and George Weigel are a little, I'll never catch you.
And Cornell West. Cornell's got more than I have.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Well, that shows you the value of an honorary doctorate. Well, listen, I want to talk to you today about many things, but fortunately you've written a book called Seeking Truth and Speaking Truth, Law and Morality in Our Cultural Moment, or really you've edited the book because it's essays that you've co-written. But in the book are all of the topics I think I would have wanted to touch on with you in any event. So let me ask you the simple opening question. What led you to put this book together?
It was a concern about the collapse of people's appreciation of the importance of truth, or even the meaning of truth. We've now had more than one generation of students who've come through our great universities believing that there's no such thing as objective truth, no such thing as the truth. There's only your truth and my truth. Truth, to the extent that it can be spoken of at all, is considered subjective. It varies from person to person. And of course, in many cases, they get all the way through university not being disabused of this clearly, in my view, fallacious idea. So as part of my vocation as a teacher, which is to form the young men and women entrusted to my charge to be determined truth seekers and courageous truth speakers, I want to confront them with the arguments in favor of objective truth. They know the arguments against it. They're very poor arguments, although they seem to so often have accepted them. But I want them to see the arguments on the other side, and then they can make up their minds. And in the overwhelming majority of cases, when students are required to think about it, to actually reflect on it, they reach the conclusion that there is a truth. It's very often hard to grasp. It's never grasped perfectly or completely or fully. We can always deepen our understanding of truth. Because we're fallible, often we need to be corrected, and that means we need to be open to challenge. But it's important to understand that there is a truth to be sought, And it's really important to seek it and to give it priority, not to live by law. One of the people I talk about in the book, Eric, as you know, is Solzhenitsyn. And Solzhenitsyn's basic story, his basic plea to us, was not to live by lies. In other words, aspire to the truth and try to live by the truth. And I'm for that.
Well, you're all for that, and me too. Well, what's interesting, I mean, it's part of the conundrum in talking about truth, is that anybody with a high view of truth, objective truth, has to admit that the project toward truth is asymptotic. You cannot ever fully get there because, you know, this brings you into the realm of theology. You know, what is truth? God is truth. Truth is infinite. Truth, it's so many things. You can understand somebody who's not an advocate of objective truth, why they would just say it is so vast that it becomes, at least it can seem subjective. It can seem impossible to nail it. You know, we can talk about 2 + 2 = 4, but when we're talking about truth, it is such a vast, ultimately incomprehensible concept. So we're sort of charged with comprehending it, but at the same time with comprehending the idea that we can never fully comprehend it. That to me is kind of the paradox, not really a conundrum when we're talking about truth.
Yeah, what you say is absolutely true, and I would just add to it that we need to recognize our own fallibility.
Okay, now right there, a lot of people would say, well, what do you mean, fallibility? Why should I acknowledge my own fallibility?
Because you'll never get at the truth unless you acknowledge your own fallibility.
Right.
You will persist in whatever errors you have in your head until you rethink the situation. And ordinarily, that's going to require someone to challenge you on the subject.
But as soon as you bring that up, you know, in other words, I can see somebody say, well, you are bringing presuppositions already. The idea that we're fallible presupposes some perfect state from which we've fallen. That's the illogical, and I don't buy it. I mean, it seems to me a lot of people who reject objective truth would say that.
I sometimes ask my students in a classroom, Eric, is there anybody out there who right now has only true ideas in your head and no false ideas? And no hands go up, and I say, well, wait a minute, no hands are going up. There's nobody out there who is infallible? And they giggle, because of course they know that they are fallible. But then I have to ask the next question. Is there anybody out there who has only true ideas, no false ideas, about the most important things, about the things that really matter to us or to you? And now they have to think, because when they give the answer that eventually they all give, which is, yes, I'm fallible, I can be wrong, I probably am wrong, not only on the minor, trivial, superficial things of life, but also on some of the big, important things in life, the things that really matter to me, the beliefs around which I actually integrate myself, my identity-forming beliefs. Once they acknowledge that, they know that they're going to have to face up to real challenges to their most fundamental beliefs. And that's hard for us human beings to do. It's hard for them. It's hard for me. I'm sure it's hard for you.
We want to
imagine that the stuff we really care about, we are absolutely 100% yeah. right about and couldn't be wrong about.
Yeah.
But the reality is that we can be wrong.
Well, again, what's interesting about this gigantic concept we call truth is we have to ask the fundamental question, what do we mean by truth, or what is truth? What do we mean when we say truth or objective truth? There are some people like, I think you knew him personally, Richard Dawkins, who
yeah.
would say...
Old friend of mine.
You were at Oxford together?
We were not only at Oxford together, we were in the same college, in the same senior common room. We had many coffees together, sat together at lunch when I was just a graduate student and a young lecturer at the university there.
Which of your three doctorates were you getting at that time?
My DPhil, my doctorate right. in philosophy.
Just want to make sure we get that. But so somebody like Dawkins, and I wrote about this in one of my books, he puts forward what to me is a patently preposterous idea that the only things we can know through scientific knowledge, which I think most people don't operate that way. But isn't that part of the problem? Is we have to talk about what we mean, and even somebody like Richard Dawkins doesn't seem to grasp that truth can be something that has to do with, you know, is murder wrong? He's not interested in going there. He says that has nothing to do with anything. I'm only interested, quote unquote, in science. That's the only way that I can get at. Would he even call it truth? I guess maybe that's another question.
Well, here's something we can know with something approaching certainty, and that is it can't be true that the only things that we can affirm are true are things whose truth we establish by scientific inquiry and scientific methods. And the reason we can be virtually certain that that's false, that that claim about truth is false, is that it can't pass its own test. It's a self-defeating proposition. Because the proposition that the only genuine knowledge is knowledge earned by scientific inquiry is not itself establishable by scientific inquiry or experimental methods. So we can throw that out. We can leave that out of, you know, we can push that off the table and then get down to the real business of, well, okay, but how can we know other things?
Well, before we get to how can we know other things, I just have to ask you, you know, whether you knew Dawkins personally or didn't. Obviously you did, but it isn't part of the larger conversation how someone like Dawkins cannot understand this, which is so simple, at least to us, it seems self-evident. But there are people like Dawkins who seem to live to disagree with what you in 40 seconds showed to be fruitless.
Well, there was a whole school of thought that was very prominent in philosophy in the late 19th and early part of the 20th century. You'll probably recall it. You won't recall it from being there at the time, but you recall it from your philosophy courses at Yale. It was called logical positivism.
Yeah.
And basically, logical positivism, sometimes known as scientism, embraced that idea that the only knowledge we can genuinely claim to have is knowledge that we've established by scientific methods. And that school of thought somehow persisted for several decades before it did collapse under its own self-referential implausibility.
In this very room, I had a conversation just like this with Hadley Arkus about natural law. I think the title of his book is Mere Natural Law.
Mere Natural Law.
And it touches on similar ideas. How can we know what we know? And there are things that we're somehow obliged to presuppose. I guess it's, I call it common sense. Do you get into that in the book? In other words,
I do.
You know,
I do. There are intelligibilities that we grasp in just our ordinary lives that are not established by scientific inquiry or really any kind of formal inquiry. One of those is the principle of non-contradiction. That something cannot both be and not be in the same respect at the same time. We all grasp the intelligibility of that. It is true. It's a truth. Something cannot both be and not be in the same respect at the same time. And then that becomes itself a principle in line with which we conduct our inquiry in other affairs. But it's not the only such truth that we grasp. Sometimes these are called self-evident truths. That's a little bit misleading because in contemporary parlance, we misuse the concept or term self-evident to mean, well, everybody agrees. That's actually not what it means. It means something that can be known to be true but can't be deduced through a middle term. The principle of non-contradiction is one of those. You can't give a formal demonstration of the principle of non-contradiction. Indeed, if you tried to do that, you'd have to employ the principle of non-contradiction in making the argument or providing the demonstration. But the same is true of other things. Take, for example, just the ordinary matter of friendship. Most people quite easily grasp the intelligible point of having or being a friend. That is, entering into relationship which you're not entering into in order to use the other person, or that person's not entering into it to use you. In fact, if you have two people, even if there's no injustice, an ordinary business partnership, for example, two people who have entered into a relationship because they both will be advanced in their pursuit of profit by it. Whatever that is, that's not a friendship, or it's not the paradigmatic case of a friendship. A friendship is where the two friends each will the good of the other for the sake of the other. And we easily grasp the intelligible point of doing that without any sort of formal demonstration. We can tell the difference between something that is intrinsically valuable, good in itself, like friendship. We can distinguish that from something that's merely instrumentally valuable, like money or an insurance policy. I mean, nobody wants an insurance policy for non-instrumental reasons.
Right.
You only want an insurance policy, right, not for its own sake, but in case something bad happens, yeah, so that your loved ones can be taken care of. I'll give you a good example of a story that illustrates the difference quite poignantly between instrumental goods or merely instrumental goods and intrinsic goods. And this story involves money as an instrumental good and friendship as an intrinsic good. And it's a story that's familiar to you and familiar to all of our viewers and listeners. It's Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol. What's the interesting thing about old Ebenezer Scrooge? Here's the interesting thing. When the story begins, he has things exactly backward, doesn't he? He's treating something that is only and obviously instrumentally good, money, as if it's intrinsically good. And he's treating something that is obviously, intelligibly, intrinsically good, friendship, as if it's only instrumentally good. He has one and only one friend, old Jacob Marley, whose ghost visits him to convert him to the right view. Marley's relationship with Scrooge was a purely business relationship, a purely instrumental relationship. But when Marley comes back and then the next three ghosts come, they show him where he's gone wrong. They show him the wounds that have darkened his capacity to understand that, no, money is merely instrumentally valuable. Friendship is what's intrinsically valuable. And once the blockages to that understanding are cleared away, not by a scientific demonstration, not by an experiment, but once those are cleared away, Scrooge becomes the best of men. He can keep Christmas if anybody knew how to keep Christmas. He adopts Tiny Tim. He sends a turkey over to the Cratchit, or a goose, it's England, a goose for Christmas over to the Cratchit family. So that's how it works in our ordinary lives. And I'm not breaking any news here. The story that I'm telling you about the intrinsic value of friendship, for example, and the way we distinguish something intrinsically valuable from something instrumentally valuable is as old as Aristotle. Yeah. We get it in Aristotle's Ethics.
Robbie, I hate to contradict my guest, but I'm sure that it was, in fact, a turkey, not a goose.
That works for me.
So I got something right here. I just want to say that. No, but I have to say that story, it's such a beautiful story. It's one of the reasons most of us love Dickens, our introduction to Dickens is A Christmas Carol. But what we're talking about truth, and it seems maybe almost ridiculous to say it, but when we're talking about truth, we're talking about what it means to be human. It's inescapable. It's not something that exists apart from humanity. It can't, which is why, you know, the materialist assertion that we can know scientific truth, it's like it's just numbers or I don't know what it is that people mean by that, but we all seem to know that no, truth has to do with what it is to be human, because you wouldn't think of an animal. You know, even a sentient animal, can an animal be sentient?
Oh, they, yeah.
I'm not sure what I mean by sentient sometimes, but, you know, it's something that's inherently human. And then I would even go farther and say that it says about what it means to be human, that we're thinking about truth, that we talk about truth. I think it shows that we're made in God's image, that we care about truth, or at least some of us would talk about truth.
That's right. What is a human being? A human being is a rational creature, a rational animal. We are animals.
Excuse me, I'm not a biologist. I can't answer that question. Keep going, because I think this is important.
Yeah, we're rational animals. That's our nature. We are creatures with a rational nature. We are not God. We are not gods. And yet, we possess an immaterial power or set of powers that is quite literally godlike. And those are the powers of reason and freedom. The power to envisage states of affairs that do not yet exist, to grasp the intelligible point, the value of bringing them into existence, and then to be able to act freely on the reasons we've grasped to bring that state of affairs into existence. Not acting on mere impulse or instinct like a brute animal, but acting rationally. This, I think, is the essence of the biblical teaching affirmed by Jews and Christians that human beings, man, although fashioned from the mere dust of the earth, material stuff that will die and dissolve, is nevertheless made in the very image and likeness of the divine creator and ruler of all that is. That's what it means to be a human being. And as rational creatures, Eric, we are truth seekers. Our fulfillment depends on, in part, there are other things as well, but a key element of our fulfillment is the pursuit of truth, the affirmation of truth, the revision of our thinking when we discover that we're in error, and then, of course, the effort to live a life authentically in line with what we best judge, fallible though we may be, to be the truth. The truth is all about being in touch with reality, whether it is natural reality, what we do in the natural sciences, social reality, we study that in the social sciences, spiritual reality, what we study in theology and religion. It means being in touch with the way things really are, not living with illusions, not living with wishful thinking, but being in touch with the way things actually are.
It's interesting that you bring that up because in the last few years, I've been talking a lot about where we are in the culture and how it seems to me that things have gotten so crazy that if you're on team reality, as I put it, we're on the same team. We don't have to agree on everything, but if you agree that there's something called reality and you want to live or try to live in accordance with it, we're on the same team. We can have a conversation. There are many people that are hostile to reality, and so they want to live in a fantasy, or they want to say that there is no reality and I will subjectively create my own reality. It's like my own truth, whatever. And it doesn't matter whether it's consonant with anything external to me, you know, which takes us back, I guess, to Rousseau or to the idea that what I feel trumps anything external and that there is no reality beyond my feelings. Where did that idea come in? Because in the book you talk about faith and reason, and I want to talk about faith and reason, but where did that come into history, this idea that, you know, my sense of things is potentially more important than anything else?
Well, I'll say a word about that, but can I pause just to commend my old friend Richard Dawkins? Because Dawkins recently in social media has taken a lot of heat for insisting that we cannot define ourselves or others as being male or female depending on their or anybody else's feelings, that our sex or so-called gender is a matter of objective reality, a matter of truth, not my truth or your truth. It doesn't vary with how you feel or how you self-identify or anything like that. And Dawkins has taken a lot of heat for doing that, but he stood up for it because he believes that it's true. This is an example for me of working with anybody who's willing to speak the truth, especially those who will speak it courageously and at a cost. We don't have to agree on everything. Dawkins and I have lots of disagreements about religion and ethics and other things, but I really do commend him for speaking out courageously when it's difficult on the question of gender ideology. And I welcome him to the movement to try to return to a kind of sensible understanding of sex and the relationship between the sexes.
And now, he's actually a biologist.
He is actually a biologist.
So maybe he can answer that question that you were asking me earlier.
What
is a human being and what is a woman?
Being?
We need to get him on the phone later.
But so, you asked me about where these ideas come in. As I said, when we talked on your radio show, especially when it comes to bad things and bad ideas, once you start tracing them back, the next thing you know, you're in the Garden of Eden, and there's the serpent and Eve. So I don't want to go all the way back there. But you mentioned Rousseau. Obviously, Rousseau is a founding father of the Romantic movement, and that's a very important moment in our history. We're talking about the 18th century. We're talking about Europe, obviously, in which the idea begins to gain credibility that we get at the truth of things when we throw off the so-called shackles of historic civilization, Christian civilization, biblical, Judeo-Christian civilization, and we live as if we were noble savages because human beings are naturally good, and therefore we can trust our instincts, our feelings, our emotions. It's a very, very bad idea. It leads to catastrophic results.
It leads to the French Revolution.
The beginning with the French Revolution, with the terror, with the guillotine. So it's a very, very bad thing, but that's a key moment. But we can't, those of us especially like myself who give a lot of credit to Anglo-American thinking, to English and American thinking, we can't just blame those continentals. These ideas, in a more polite form, are entering into Anglo-American thought, English thought in the first instance, British thought, also in the 18th century and even earlier. I'm thinking of David Hume, who famously declares that reason is and ought only to be the slave of the passions and may pretend to no office other than to serve and obey them. That's the idea that we can't actually adjudicate rationally. We can't reason about what to want. Our wants will be brute givens, given by our desires. All we can reason about is how to get to what we want, how more efficiently to get what we want. Now look at the implications of that. Hitler wants to murder a lot of Jews and Slavs and others. Mother Teresa wants to rescue people on the and care for them on the streets of Calcutta. According to the Humean view, not that Hume himself embraced any such thing, but the implications of his view are is that Hitler can't reason, or we can't reason, about the genuine truthfulness or desirability of what Hitler wants. He wants what he wants, and that's all that can be said. All reason can do is to help him more efficiently to achieve his ends. We can't judge Mother Teresa's wants to be superior or inferior. All reason can do is tell Mother Teresa how to be more efficient in caring for people on the streets of Calcutta. And it doesn't, as I say, even in the English tradition, in the English Anglophone tradition, begin with Hume. A couple of generations earlier, Thomas Hobbes had written that the thoughts are to the desires, as scouts and spies to range abroad and find the way to the thing desired.
But that's not really proscriptive, is it? He's just describing what he sees in the fallen
world. But it's
proscriptive
in this sense. He's indicating what is possible and what is not possible. And his argument is all that is possible is to reason about how to get what you want. It's not possible to reason about what to want.
Okay, so that's...
So it's a rejection of two streams, the two streams that really formed the West. One stream, of course, the biblical tradition, Jerusalem. The other stream, the classical tradition from Greece and Rome, figures like Plato and Aristotle and Cicero, who are nowhere near the idea that all reason can do is tell us how to get what we want. Both of those traditions, the Judeo-Christian tradition and the classical tradition, are fundamentally interested in trying to adjudicate between our wants in a way that's rational. Getting at the truth is what Mother Teresa wants the right thing to want, or is what Hitler wants the right thing to want. They both can't be okay.
And by the way, just for the sake of the conversation, I'm going with Mother Teresa.
Okay.
So it's interesting how cynical that view is, that, you know, when you talk about Hume and Hobbes, maybe you know enough about them to say whether they were so cynical.
Hobbes, I think I can explain somewhat. He's writing in the context and wake of the Great Civil War, the British Civil War, English. And, you know, it was catastrophic. and the carnage was profound. And human beings looked to him, the creatures who would do this to each other, looked to him basically like just brute animals driven by desire. And I think the cynicism grew out of that experience. Mm. It's parallel, Eric, to the cynicism, I think, of Oliver Wendell Holmes, the great American jurist, profoundly cynical person. Great jurist, but a profoundly cynical person. His cynicism grew out of his experience with the American Civil War, serving in the Union forces in that war, seeing the carnage. It was really horrific. And wars can take people in different directions. The experience of war can take people in different directions. It can inspire in our hearts a deep desire to do the right thing so that something like this will never happen again. In others, it will lead to this kind of cynicism. And I fear in Hobbes, as in Holmes, it led to that cynicism.
I, some months ago, interviewed a Plato scholar and was talking to him about how it's fascinating to me as a Christian to think that people like Plato or Socrates or Cicero, that they would have somehow intuitively grasped that it's possible to reason your way in the direction of something called truth. In other words, that they had an innate sense that there was something like truth and that we could reason toward that. And I was asking him, and I'll ask you now, what do you suppose it is? Because we can talk about the cynicism of Oliver Wendell Holmes or of a Hobbes, but what do you suppose it would be that would make somebody, in let's say Socrates, have this innate sense that the unexamined life is not worth living, as we say at almost every Socrates event, and that it's worth examining life, it's worth thinking deeply, it's worth trying to reason our way toward something. I mean, I would say that comes from whether we know it or not, that we're made in God's image. But it's fascinating to me that these folks, centuries before Christ, had that sense, and they, of course, had no, conversations with the Hebrews. They weren't aware of the writings of Moses.
Let me begin with 2 points in response, Eric. First is that this is not a new view. People have been asking the same question going all the way back to early Christianity. Second, you're in very good company, because some of the great early Christian thinkers asked themselves the question, how could Plato have known what he knew? And there were two bits of speculation, both of which were ultimately rejected, but they were at least toyed with in the minds of early Christian thinkers. One was, could Plato have had somehow access to the Hebrew revelation? Did he get a scroll from somewhere? And then the second speculation, also in the end dismissed, not embraced, was that God had given him a private revelation of some of the essential content of the Hebrew scriptures. Now, both are rejected, but the fact that they were entertained at all means that your question occurred to them as well. Now, my answer, I think, is very much in line with your answer, and here we can go to another great Jewish thinker, St. Paul. And St. Paul tells us in his letter to the Romans that there is a law written on the hearts even of the Gentiles. Who are the Gentiles? They're the people who don't have the law of Moses. There's a law written on the hearts of the Gentiles. It's not written on scrolls like the Bible. Written on the hearts of the Gentiles that is sufficient for them to be held accountable. It enables them to know basic right from wrong. So a great figure like Socrates, like Plato, I would add Aristotle or Cicero, I think is someone who is deeply exploring with a good heart, with a good intention, that law written on the heart. That law we call these days the natural law. Martin Luther King invokes it in his famous letter from the Birmingham jail when he's criticized for breaking the law, which he did, breaking the human law, breaking the positive law of the state. How can he justify that? Especially when they said to him, his critics said to him, Dr. King, you yourself called for obedience to law when the Supreme Court handed down its decision in Brown versus Board of Education, ordering the desegregation of the schools in the southern states, and when there was resistance from the white majority. You called for obedience to law, but now you're breaking the law. And King says, well, that's because there are two types of law. There's the human law, but then there's the higher law. There are two types of law in another sense. There's unjust law and there's just law. An unjust law is a human law that is in violation of the natural law, the moral law, the law written on the hearts. That's what an unjust law is. A just law is a law that's in line with the natural law, in line with the moral law. A law that's in line with the moral law uplifts what he called in the letter the human personality. In other contexts, he called the human spirit. By contrast, an unjust law, a law that's out of whack with the natural law, degrades the human being, both the victim of the wrongdoing and the wrongdoer himself. Well, that's pretty good. And we can understand that law, at least to some extent, at least in principle, as Plato shows, as Aristotle shows, as Cicero shows, even if we don't have the revealed truth of the scripture.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. It is, it's fascinating to me that the ancients, all the way back in antiquity, got this, and that many moderns who've had the benefit of living, you know, many centuries after the New Testament was written, could get to a point where they would argue with that.
It does undermine the progressive view of history, doesn't it?
Yes.
That we keep getting better and better and better, yeah, and smarter and smarter and smarter. Things are a lot more complicated than the Neo-Hegelians would have us believe, who think that history moves forward in a positive direction,
yeah,
and we're always making progress.
Yeah.
No, we're not.
No.
We can make progress in some domains, like in the domain of science, and yet regress, lose knowledge when it comes to moral truth or,
yeah,
spiritual truth.
Where do you think we are now with regard to that? You know, because it's interesting to look at. I mean, you know, it's one thing to say that, you know, if you want to trace things back, you have to go back to Eden, but intellectual history is different. I mean, there are moments.
Yeah.
You know, there's the age of reason, where people are somehow stressing reason and rationality. The age of faith before that, to some extent. Where do you see us now? And I assume that part of the reason you wrote this book is because of where you think we are now.
Well, in the introduction to Seeking Truth and Speaking Truth, my new book there in your lap, in the introduction, I make the point that historians are fond of breaking the epochs up into the age of this and the age of that. And so they tell us that the medieval period was the age of faith. Now, what do they mean by that? Well, they mean that for the great medieval thinkers, whether they were Jews like Maimonides or Christians like Thomas Aquinas or Muslims like Averroes, whoever they were, for the great medieval thinkers, the principal touchstone of truth and of goodness and of justice and of rightness is conformity with the will of God, conformity to the truths of faith. Now, that shouldn't mislead us into thinking that they had a low view of reason. They certainly did not. If you read Thomas Aquinas or Maimonides, you'll see a figure who believes that reason has a lot to disclose to us. It has a luminosity and a power. And yet there's truth in the idea that for the medievals, faith had priority. Faith and reason together, but faith had priority. Well, these same historians tell us, Eric, that the Enlightenment era in Europe was the age of reason. They sometimes call it the age of science. Well, what do they mean? They mean that for the great Enlightenment thinkers, the touchstone of truth and of goodness and of rightness is conformity with reason, conformity with what we can figure out using the old noggin, perhaps by the experimental methods of science or by some other methods, but it's conformity with rationality. Now, again, we need to be careful not to exaggerate that or allow it to mislead us, because while there were some Enlightenment figures who were hardcore dogmatic secularists, many were not. Many were men of faith. But there's truth in the idea that the Enlightenment period in Europe was the age of reason. Well, if the medieval period was the age of faith and the Enlightenment was the age of reason, in what way age do we live today? And here's where the danger is. I regret to say, my dear brother Eric, that we live in the age of feeling. Because instead of faith or reason, or as I would prefer, faith and reason together being the touchstone of truth, of goodness, of justice, we've, in many cases, many people, especially many young people, treat feeling, emotion, as the touchstone, as the guide to truth. And that's how we get ridiculous ideas floating about, like the idea that you have your truth and I have my truth and there's no such thing as the truth. And until we overcome that idea and get back to faith and reason, I hope operating together as the two wings, in the words of John Paul II, the late pontiff, two wings on which the human spirit ascends to contemplation of the truth. Until we get back to that, we're going to be going down a very bad road where it will be very easy to justify more and more atrocities, especially in the area of biomedical ethics, justify more and more atrocities on the basis of how I feel.
I knew this would happen talking to you, Robbie, that I want to go in so many different directions. We'll just have to have you back. I mean, we still have time, but I want to talk to you about some of the figures that you mentioned toward the end of the book, the first of whom is Alexander Solzhenitsyn. I'm sorry to say that there are many people who probably don't know anything about Solzhenitsyn. We take for granted, because of our age, that everybody must know who Solzhenitsyn is.
Alas, I wish.
But talk a little bit about Alexander Solzhenitsyn.
It's a great figure. A prophet raising his voice against Soviet communist totalitarianism and expansionism. For our young viewers who may not know the name or know anything about him, even if the name is one that they've heard before. He suffered in the Soviet gulag. He was a writer, a novelist, in the great tradition of figures like Tolstoy and Dostoevsky in Russia. He's a great novelist. And because his ideas threatened the Soviet gangster leadership, he was put in prison in the gulag, where he did some of his greatest writing. And then when they released him from prison, and he was by now an acclaimed and prize-winning international human rights advocate, he came to the United States as an exile. And when he was here, while he was here in 1978, he was invited to give the commencement address at Harvard.
Before you go on, I have to say, thinking back to the 70s and thinking back to who Solzhenitsyn was when he was invited by Harvard, it tells us a lot about where we are today and where we were then.
Yes.
The idea that Harvard would invite Solzhenitsyn was because everyone at that time could agree on the brutal depravity of how the Soviet Union treated its political enemies like Solzhenitsyn. So he was a hero in a way that it's hard for us to think of anybody in that way today.
He was indeed, and it was to Harvard's credit. Harvard, very liberal institution. I happened to be there in 1978. I was a student at Harvard Law School at the time. I wasn't within the walls at the ceremony, but I could hear the speech over the loudspeaker. And Harvard was a very liberal place in those days. There's no question about that. And there were lots of people who, you know, were falling into the error of believing a kind of moral equivalency. Well, the Soviet Union may be bad, but, you know, we're not so good either, and we're imperialist and we're expansionist. And, you know, it was a really defective view. I mean, that's not to say that we shouldn't acknowledge our faults. That's good, that we should have some humility ourselves about the wrongs that we have done, you know, beginning with the great sin of slavery. And yet, you know, by 1978, to suppose that the Soviet Union and the United States were moral equivalents was disgusting. And everyone expected Solzhenitsyn to condemn that view. But I think Harvard was surprised and probably not completely happy with what they got from Solzhenitsyn. They knew he would condemn Soviet gangsterism. I don't think they were prepared for what he gave us, which was a critique of the West, a critique of the West for its vices, for the kind of expressive individualism, to use the label given to the dominant ideology of our time. It was there in 78, it's here today. The name given by the great late Berkeley sociologist Robert Bella. It's what ultimately gives us this ridiculous idea of your truth and my truth.
You could also call it secular materialism.
Secular materialism. And Solzhenitsyn, who was a great Christian figure, Eastern Orthodox Christian, Russian Orthodox Christian, he gave a profound critique on that day of Western secularism. He would develop that 5 years later when he received the Templeton Prize, 1983, in a speech in which he declared that the fundamental errors of the West that have led to our loss of courage, our loss of integrity, our falling into vices like widespread pornography and promiscuity and drugs and so forth, that at the bottom, he said, it's because men have forgotten God. Here he's actually echoing one of our own great historical prophets, Abraham Lincoln, who in the midst of the Civil War in 1863, Eric, in declaring a day of prayer and fasting, a day of repentance in the midst of the war, argued in his statement that this carnage, this war, had come on us because we as a people have forgotten God. This is exactly the message, basically, of the Old Testament prophets. It's the message at the end of the day of all true prophets. We need to remember God. Remember that we are under authority, that we do not get to make up reality. There's a reality over against us that it's our job to understand and to live in line with.
Well, it's... There's really almost nobody like Solzhenitsyn. I mean, the idea that he would suffer as he did under the brutality of Soviet communism and then come to the West a hero, celebrated as a hero, and then given this, yeah. this plum spot to be the speaker at graduation and then to do what he did, it's extraordinary. But as you say, I mean... He's pointing us, like all true prophets must do, to God.
Yeah.
And it's interesting to me because I'm writing a book on the American Revolution now, and I'm fascinated with how this was the Puritan view and this was absolutely John Adams's view, that if we turn to God, we can win this war. If we have to be concerned with that. We have to be, I mean, obviously Lincoln said we have to make sure that we're on God's, it's not whether God is on our side or
we're
on God's
side.
And Adams strongly champions that idea. And I think that is where we are now in the culture, is that there's this question of, is there such thing as a transcendent reality? Is there such thing as truth? And then what is our job at this point?
Eric, I'd like to make a plea even to those who, in good faith, good people, doing their best, can't find their way. I know people like this, have at least not yet able to find their way to belief in a personal God, to the God of the Bible. Even if they can't, please understand, please grasp, which I know you can, and many of you do, that there is such a thing as reality. One that is over against us that we don't manufacture out of our own head or out of our own viscera, out of our own emotions. And it's our job to try to understand reality, be in touch with reality, and live in line with reality, including moral reality. We can do that even if we don't have what some would call the gift of faith. I know my great friend Harvey Mansfield at Harvard. You must know Professor Mansfield. He He's not himself a religious believer. He's got great respect for the Christian and Jewish traditions. He's certainly very warm to believers. He's been the mentor of many students, doctoral students and others, who are Christian or believing Jewish people. And yet he can't find his way to faith. Nevertheless, he's able to model what it means to strive for truth, to discover truth, however imperfectly, and then to try to live in line with truth. We all ought to aspire at a minimum to that.
Well, I mean, you're touching on what I said earlier about being on team reality. I think we're at a point where things have gone so haywire that people, whether it's Richard Dawkins or J.K. Rowling, anybody who senses the madness says, well, wait a minute. There's this thing called reality. We have to deal with this. And I think increasingly, as people do that, in reaction to the madness, that we say, wait a minute, there's this thing called reality. Let's agree on the basics. As, you know, Richard Dawkins would agree on the biological basis. There's male and female, and there's this thing called reality. I would say that that's God's way, by forcing us to live in reality or as part of reality, of helping us grope our way toward him, even if we're not conscious of that.
Agreed. The way I have put it on Twitter and elsewhere is anybody who sincerely, with a pure heart, is seeking the truth is kin to me. He might be Catholic, as I am. He might be evangelical Protestant. He might be Eastern Orthodox. He might be Jewish. He might be Muslim. He might be Mormon. He might be Buddhist. He might be an atheist. But if he's sincerely seeking the truth, and especially if he's prepared courageously to speak the truth as best he's given to understand the truth, then he is kin to me. That is my brother.
I'm radically where you are. I've said almost the same thing, not as eloquently, but I think that that's it's fascinating that we're finding ourselves in that kind of a cultural moment. And it gives me great hope, frankly, that things have gone crazy enough that a lot of people are waking up and saying, wait a minute, let's see if we can reason our way forward.
We call that in academia, Eric, the vibe shift.
I was wondering where that came from. Of course it came from academia, the old vibe shift. Yes, we're in the midst of a vibe shift. Now, there are other figures you talk about in the book, and I want to touch on them, but say what you were going to say before I do that.
Well, I was going to talk a bit about the vibe shift, how that cashes out, for example, for my students at Princeton with whom I've discussed this, and they all agree there's been a significant vibe shift over the last year or two, really the last year. There's been a difference in the tone on campus, and more importantly, a difference in the questions you're allowed to raise and the ideas that you are allowed to subject to questioning and criticism. A year and a half, 2 years ago, there were people who knew that there are big problems at the heart of gender ideology or transgender ideology, but they didn't feel they could safely speak up about them or raise questions about them, much less challenge them. But that's changed now. That's the vibe shift. You can now raise questions about that or aspects of DEI ideology, which, you know, were dogmatic orthodoxies at Princeton or Harvard or University of Illinois or University of Kansas until about a year or so ago. And now it's possible to raise questions in class or out of class, you know, in the dining hall or in the dorms late at night. You no longer have to worry about being expelled from the human race or rendered a non-person or defamed on social media.
And how did that happen? It's like a fever broke.
It's like a fever broke. I think that's right. People got sick of it. I think the election, especially the fact that Donald Trump not only won the electoral vote, but even the popular vote, made it clear that woke ideology does not enjoy anything approaching majority support in this country. And things are going in the wrong direction in terms of popular opinion for the woke ideologues. In any case, however it happened, it happened. And it makes a real difference for the kinds of conversations that you can have on campus now.
I'm pretty sure he only won because of Russian interference. But I don't want to go in. This is not the time to adjudicate that question. I want to talk to you about some of the other figures you mentioned at the end of the book. You mentioned Heinrich Heine. Talk about Heine.
Remarkable story that I relate in the book. Heine was a German Jewish Christian poet in the early part of the 19th century. And around 1830, Eric, he published some essays on religion and society, in which he noted with great emphasis the fact that Germany was losing its historic Christian faith, especially losing the moral substance of the Christian faith. And he warned, in language that only a great poet could come up with, he warned that when Christianity falls, and it is falling in Germany, intellectually it is collapsing in Germany, when it falls, then those Teutonic gods, those warlike gods that have been buried for 1,000 years will rise from their tombs, they'll rub the sand out of their eyes, and Thor, he says, with his giant hammer, will rise up and smash the great cathedrals. And then, you ready for this?
Yes.
He says, a play will be enacted in Germany that will make the bloodshed of the French Revolution look like an innocent idyll. Eric, 100 years before the rise of Hitler, Heinrich Heine predicted the Nazi atrocities.
Yeah.
He didn't use the name National Socialism or Nazism.
Yeah.
He didn't talk about Hitler or a guy with a little mustache. But he saw that something would happen as a result of the collapse of Christian morality in Central Europe that would make the French Revolution look like nothing, look like just innocent fun, an innocent idyll. I mean, how prophetic.
Oh, it's prophetic. It's definitely prophetic. There's no question. I'm always fascinated by figures who speak prophetically without knowing that they're speaking prophetically. You know, he wouldn't have said, I'm a prophet.
No, he just
would think, well, it stands to reason.
He said something particular about standing to reason. It's something we would do well to take on board. Please, all viewers, listen to this. He said, thought precedes action, as lightning precedes thunder. What happens in the domain of the visible first happened in the domain of the invisible, in the domain of the intellect. Bad ideas, the replacement of Judeo-Christian morality with a kind of neo-pagan, the worst kind of neo-pagan ideology, doesn't stop in the realm of ideas. It cashes out in dead bodies, in atrocities, in carnage. Thought precedes action as thunder precedes lightning. We need to take that lesson on board.
Oh, we certainly do, and it's a chilling prophecy because we know what happened. I don't think you quote it in this chapter here, but I quote it in my Bonhoeffer book. He says, I'm not sure if it's in the same essay, but Heine said, where books are burned, human beings will be burned also. Who could have dreamt?
Human
beings, of course, had been literally burnt at the stake for centuries when he said that, but
not in the kind of masses.
Well, certainly not. No, obviously. But it does seem that he's prophetically speaking of what happened under the Nazis. And, of course, the Nazis did really often privately, but nonetheless explicitly, reject the Christian God.
They explicitly, Eric, revived Teutonic paganism.
Right.
Their marriage ceremonies were pagan marriage ceremonies.
Yeah.
They were invoking the German gods, the ancient Teutonic gods, precisely for their warlike character in contrast to the gentleness and love ethic of Christianity.
And I think we would say, you and I being Christians, that those gods are demons. that's the horror, that you open the door to the demonic, and that to me is exactly what happened in Germany. But it's interesting to me that in the 1830s already Heine saw this. I'm not really familiar with German cultural history of the early 19th century. Do you say what it was?
The time of German unification. And you know what he's perceiving is what's happening in the intellectual culture. Not so much on the ground. That would come, he knew, because changes in the domain of the intellect, thought, end up cashing out in the domain of the visible.
Yeah.
Bad ideas have consequences. Now, what that doesn't mean, Eric, it doesn't mean we should ban bad ideas.
Right.
You can't do that. That's the wrong way.
Correct.
You meet bad ideas with good ideas.
Right. Which takes us, back to 17th century England and John Milton's Areopagitica. I'm fascinated that is debated today, whether we ought to have free speech. These things that you and I perhaps thought self-evident. Suddenly, there are a couple of generations that aren't so sure that free speech is self-evidently the right way to go.
It's remarkable, Eric. I'm a little older than you are, but I'm certainly old enough to remember, I think you probably are, when free speech was considered a liberal value, a left-wing value. And maybe it was conservatives who weren't quite so strict about free speech. Well, today, at least in academic culture and universities where, like the one in which I teach, if you say free speech, that's code for conservatism. That's considered a right-wing idea. When did that happen? The fundamental case for free speech is the case that's made by figures like Milton and John Stuart Mill. I've spent much of my career, as you know, Eric, being a critic of the kind of liberalism that John Stuart Mill represents. And yet, I have to acknowledge, Mill gives us an excellent argument for freedom of speech in the second chapter of his great essay on liberty, where he says that free speech, like other fundamental freedoms, is not an abstract right. It's not just an implication of fairness. I should let you say what you want because I want you to let me say what I want. No, he says free speech is important because it serves a value. And the value above all that it serves is the value of truth seeking with a view to getting, or at least getting as close as we can get, to the truth. We're all going to have in our heads at any given moment of our lives a mixture of true and false beliefs. Some of the beliefs in our heads will be true, some will be false. Now the question is, how can we maximize the number of true beliefs and minimize the number of false beliefs? How do we swap the false beliefs out of our head for true beliefs? Here's one way not to do it. If I shut down your right to challenge me, or if I turn away and won't listen to you challenge me, if I will only listen to people who confirm me in what I already believe, well, yes, you'll confirm me in what I believe that happens to be true, but you'll also confirm me in what I believe that happens to be false. And I'm not going to get anywhere toward the truth. We should respect free speech not because there is no truth, but for the very opposite reason, that free speech serves the good of truth-seeking. And that means, above all, in institutions whose fundamental purpose for existing is truth-seeking, colleges and universities. Mm. You need free speech. You need free speech the way the human body or any organism needs oxygen in order to live. Without free speech, intellectual life dies.
Both of us remember the famous story in Skokie, Illinois, of the neo-Nazis marching through a predominantly Jewish neighborhood.
Not just Jewish, Holocaust survivors.
Even more dramatically, Holocaust survivors. And I believe the ACLU at the time defended the right of the neo-Nazis to do that. Obviously didn't agree with it, but nonetheless defended their right to do that.
At great cost to the organization. They lost many of their members. They lost many of their largest donors. But it was a principle for them. And they stood
That's
up for the principle.
That's back when the ACLU had principles. We're old enough
to... It was a different ACLU
We're old enough
days,
to remember that ACLU.
Yeah, it was a different ACLU in those days. I mean, this is why I've been joined with colleagues to found the Academic Freedom Alliance, to do the kind of work that the ACLU or the American Association of University Professors should be doing. But they have been captured. They've gone in a kind of woke ideological direction. So they're not standing up for the values that they used to at least proclaim. And so we need new organizations to do that, and the Academic Freedom Alliance is one of them.
We just got a couple of minutes, and I wanted to make sure we talked about banjo playing.
Yes.
I've had the joy of listening to you play the banjo, and the last chapter of at the end of the book, you talk about Ralph Stanley. Talk a little bit about who he was and why he's in your book.
Well, first, Eric, I want to assure your viewers, since you've outed me as a banjo player, that I came by my banjo playing honestly. I was born and brought up in north central West Virginia in the heart of Appalachia. Both my grandfathers were coal miners.
People who are watching the video can tell, obviously, that you come from Appalachia.
There I am, see? And banjos are issued to little boys at birth where I come from, so I came by my banjo playing honestly. But I love the bluegrass banjo. I love bluegrass music. It was the soundtrack of my childhood, hunting and fishing and playing bluegrass music.
I mean, you're not
Rod and Gun
making
Club.
This up. You mean this is true?
Everything I've just said is true. When I arrived at college, I was an undergraduate at Swarthmore, and I like to say that I arrived at college from central West Virginia, or north central West Virginia, shoeless with a banjo on my back. The banjo on my back part is true. The shoeless is metaphorical.
Yeah.
But the banjo on my back part is true. So as a bluegrass lover and as a bluegrass banjo player in particular, I had three great heroes. They were the founders of the bluegrass method of playing the banjo, so-called three-finger method of playing the banjo. Earl Scruggs is the most famous and probably the one who deserves the lion's share of the credit. I have great respect for Scruggs as a musician. A man named Don Reno. Scruggs was from North Carolina. Reno was from Tennessee, was another great one that has certainly influenced my playing. And then the third was Ralph Stanley. He wasn't quite a West Virginian, but he was about as close as you can be. He was from Western Virginia, from the Clinch Mountain area of Virginia. And he played the most traditional kind of bluegrass music, that which was closest to the old-fashioned mountain music. And not only was he a great banjo player, he was an unselfconscious, but in his own way, prophetic Christian believer. His music and his faith were integrated. And it was the integration of his music, which I love, with his faith. He's an evangelical and I'm a Catholic, but it's a shared Christian faith, the faith that we share, that caused me to include in the book the tribute that I wrote to him when he died a few years ago. I remember, Eric, he was being interviewed, just as you're interviewing me, but his interviewer was a PBS interviewer. I've forgotten the man's name. But the PBS interviewer was asking him about his life and his music, and Stanley was quite unselfconsciously telling his story, and of course, faith was at the heart of his story, and he wasn't just talking about his faith. He was proclaiming his faith to the PBS interviewer as he was telling his story, and you could see the interviewer, like a deer in the headlights, very uncomfortable in this situation, uncomfortable even with the discussion of faith, much less the public display of faith. But Stanley was oblivious to it. He just went on, and it was a most remarkable experience.
Well, I'm so sorry we're out of time, but it's just a joy to speak with you, Robbie. Thanks for everything you do at Princeton and elsewhere. Thanks for the book, Seeking Truth and Speaking Truth, Law and Morality in Our Cultural Moment. Thank you.
It's my pleasure, Eric. Good to be with you.